But I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate. We think too much and feel too little. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness. Without these qualities, life will be violent. And all will be lost. Do not despair. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die. And dictators die. And the power they took from the people will return to the people. Will return to the people. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, to do away with greed. Now let us fight to free the world, to fulfill that promise. Let us all unite.
Welcome, welcome, folks, here in the Corporation Nation. It is the 27th of February, 2015, Friday. Oh, thank goodness. Well, folks, special guest today. Actually, Patrick Wood is my guest. He sent me an email the other day. I wasn't too familiar with his work, but it's actually pretty good stuff. His website is technocracyrising.com. That's technocracyrising.com. Patrick is an author and lecturer, studied elite globalization policy since the late 1970s when he partnered with the late Anthony C. Sutton, co-author Trilaterals Over Washington, Volumes 1 and 2, and remains a leading expert on the elitist Trilateral Commission, their policies and achievements in creating their self-proclaimed new international economic order. That's their term, not Patrick's. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Hey, good to be with you, Clint.
Well, I'm pleased you could join me today. So you actually sent the original contact with me was over this. The title is United Nations says the purpose of climate change is to kill capitalism. What a strange notion that is, huh?
Yeah, really. It's somewhat of a deception on their part, but I have to say deception has been their middle name for decades. So
par for the course.
No surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what is that? What do you mean when you say purpose of climate change is to kill capitalism?
Well, climate change, and we'll put this in context of technocracy, I hope, in a minute here, but climate change is a scare tool to cause people to move in a certain direction. And that certain direction happens to be Agenda 21, sustainable development, and all the things that are associated with it. Climate change is not climate change by itself, in other words. But it's a driver. It's the emergency or the crisis that needs to be managed, and therefore, if we don't do all these things, why, we're all going to die because climate change is going to kill us, or something thereabouts. You know, the seas are going to rise and we'll all drown or something. But the United Nations has been steadfast on climate change for a long time, in spite of evidence to the contrary. And it was just instructive that the head of climate change at the United Nations actually came out and admitted, finally, that the purpose of climate change was really not climate change in itself. It was to move people to accept and create policies to implement Agenda 21 and sustainable development all over the world. That's what it's all about.
So, to be clear, the purpose of quote-unquote battling climate change, or the creation of the devil that is climate change, mm-hmm. is specifically to instill in people the notion that they need to accept all the things that revolve around Agenda 21, from smart this to smart that, carbon credits and all the carbon footprint nonsense and all that stuff.
That's exactly right. And in the larger context, we also need to realize that technocracy is a replacement economic system for capitalism.
And so how do you define technocracy?
Well, you have to go back to the 1930s to pick up the historical movement called technocracy or Technocracy Incorporated. And you find out exactly what they meant by using that term and by, you know, the people that were architecting it and so on. It was created by a group of highly intellectual scientists and engineers, many of them at Columbia University at the time. And they believed that capitalism was dead in 1932 because of the Great Depression. And they believed that technology had forever changed the fabric of society. And therefore, they, and only they, were really qualified to run society. So they basically wanted all the politicians just to hand everything over to them and let them run society according to their scientific method and system theory. And they didn't succeed, fortunately. But in the process of several years of doing this, it was a major movement in the United States. They had over 500,000 members at one time.
Well, it's safe to say that the historical way that, especially in modern times, that those type of quote-unquote movements do succeed is through incrementalism, the incremental sort of sneak up on you through things like Agenda 21, not the sudden just handing over of everything to a group like that, but they kind of sneak in through the back doors, create all kinds of propaganda and everything else, and then all of a sudden they're in control before you even know what happened.
Well, that's that has happened. Back in the 30s, there was no institutional money given to these people. In other words, the Rockefeller crowd and the Carnegie crowd, et cetera, they did not swarm these people to give them money. They basically were on their own. But because they were, you know, many of them tenured professors at places like Columbia, they had money to spend of their own to architect their economic model. And so it went kind of underground or dormant for a period of years until it got picked up again around 1970 originally by Zbigniew Brzezinski, I believe. And it was inducted into the Trilateral Commission, which was co-founded by Brzezinski and David Rockefeller. And this is where the money started to pour into the concept. And my book documents how the Trilateral Commission moved forward with technocracy to produce the things that we're talking about already. And we've already introduced Agenda 21 and sustainable development and smart grid and Common Core and other things like that. All of these doctrines can be traced back to the 1930s, but the implementation of these in the modern context, I lay at the feet of the Trilateral Commission and its members over the last 40 years. And I think that evidence trail is very compelling at this point.
So you're saying that the old technocracy movement basically moved into the Trilateral Commission?
That's right. And, you know, as I've studied globalization since the 1970s, I've noticed one thing about these people. And, you know, they always view themselves as being the enlightened ones, you know, that they have the PhDs and, you know, the rest of us are just kind of limping along on half a brain. And these people, on the other hand, have never had an original idea of their own.
Yeah,
everything they've had, they've hijacked from somebody else. And so it doesn't surprise me that they would hijack, you know, this kind of crackpot utopian scheme from the 1930s and say, hey, this looks like a good idea. Why don't we try this? And, you know, it's a radical economic system that was defined primarily in a book, by the way, that they produced called the Technocracy Study Course. And that's available on the Internet. Somebody scan it, put it out there. You can find it if you blog.
Who produced that?
That was produced by Technocracy Incorporated.
Oh, okay. Wow, scary stuff.
So, you know, you look at it, and basically what they proposed back then as a utopian system was to scuttle capitalism altogether and replace it with an energy-based economy. They wanted to do away with money. They wanted to implement a currency-based script system where people would have energy credits to spend instead of money. There'd be no supply and demand. per se, to determine prices. Prices would be determined on the energy it took to build something or to make something.
That sounds familiar.
Well, this is cap and trade and, you know, stuff like this today. And actually, there are scholars talking about energy currency today as well, just flat out. You know, okay, we just need to do away with money and price everything in terms of energy currency. But we see these things being implemented today, and it's absolutely unmistakable that they're using the doctrines from the 1930s, but they're doing it with a few different twists and stuff. They've added some extra stuff. We could probably call it neo-technocracy at this point, in a sense.
I see. So,
but it's still the same stuff.
Right. Is it safe to say then, because we always seem to go back and we say, well, Agenda 21, for instance, is the source of all of this crazy stuff we're going through now, but really the source of Agenda 21 then would be sort of an altered state of technocracy, so we really have to go back to the source?
That's exactly right. That's exactly why I wrote the book, and that was exactly my research on the subject.
So we're all caught up then in sort of the modern version of something much older and deeper. And this is perhaps why we can't figure out how to prevent it or stop it or or even figure out why the heck it's happening.
Well, that's a good part of it. And you know, that just kind of brings up the point. You can't fight a war with an enemy you don't recognize. And this has been I'm embarrassed to say, I thought I knew something about American history. But when I learned about technocracy several years ago, I just was flabbergasted. I said, why didn't I ever hear about this? And I read books, and I talked to people, and, you know, why didn't I know about this stuff? And I found out there was reasons for it later, but still I was kind of embarrassed that I didn't really pick up on it earlier. But it's been out there for everybody to see. I found research finally. I bought a bunch of old rare books from the 1930s and 40s and stuff, and I found out everything I needed to know before I wrote the book. But when I connected it to the Trilateral Commission and just kind of worked it forward, and you know, you just follow the money, right? When you follow the money, you see the Trilateral Commission coming into this in 1973, and all of a sudden, all these programs start to materialize out of thin air. And you say, well, who is doing that? And you go and look at it. Well, there's another member of the Trilateral Commission. Son of a gun. How do they get around all these different places?
It's amazing, you know, isn't it?
Well, you know, I know one of the biggest revelations or startling pieces of information that I ran across was the so-called Brundtland Commission, which I'm sure you're familiar with because you know some of the history of Agenda 21. Mm. The Brundtland Commission that was commissioned by the United Nations concluded in 1987, was singularly the work that created or paved the way for the Earth Summit. Even the United Nations admits that very openly. They write about the leader of that task force. Her name was Gro Brundtland, with great reverence. And you know, they credit her with being the mover and shaker and driver or whatever of all the policies that produced Agenda 21 at the Earth Summit. Well, Gro Brundtland was a member, still is, a member of the Trilateral Commission. Well, son of a gun.
Surprise.
What is she doing there? Surprise. And there's other things like that that have come along where these people keep showing up in key positions, and it's way beyond coincidence, I'll tell you what. And, you know, so anyway, I've been tracking this for a long time, and when I finally put everything together, I realized that the end game really is technocracy, and all of these things are driving us towards it. And capitalism is set up for death. You know, I mean, I think there's a death warrant on capitalism right now, and I think the United Nations has finally realized that they need to just give way to the moral hazard. Let's just push Humpty Dumpty right off the hill and right off the wall and break him to pieces.
Well, it certainly, you know, in the strangest of ways, it makes sense. You know, you have to admit that there is a certain ingenious, though diabolical, logic behind all this. And of course, the presentation of it is very, it pulls on the heartstrings. It has to do with the environment and saving animals and, you know, preventing the green from going brown. It's all very well presented. And so the propaganda of this thing has, I mean, that's probably the most impressive part of it, that none of this can be traced back, as you say, to the notion of the technocracy corporation. Now, one question. Was there a prior organization or thought process, perhaps from another country or nation or time, that the technocracy group actually was formed from?
Oh, absolutely. It goes back to the father of technocracy, who was a Frenchman by the name of Henri de Saint-Simon. And he lived from 1760 to 1825. He was a French philosopher, and he's widely credited as being the father of technocracy that actually rolled into the early 1900s. And he wrote back then, just to give you an idea of the mindset that he had, he said, "A scientist, my dear friends, is a man who foresees. It is because science provides the means to predict that it is useful, and the scientists are superior to all other men." Close quote.
Nice.
So you see where some of the big heads come from. And you also see an element of religion in this as well, because he claimed that science, one of the major facets of science, is its ability to predict. And so when, this is not based on good science, because I don't think it's really given to us to know the future. But when scientists believe they have the power to accurately predict the future, you get into all kinds of trouble.
Sure.
You take Paul Ehrlich's book from 1978 that was called The Population Bomb. He believed that mankind was going to be wall-to-wall or elbow-to-elbow humanity within 25 to 30 years. We're all going to die from starvation or eat each other. I don't know what we do, but his book sold millions and millions of copies around the world. It was translated into languages. The guy was a hero. But looking back, not one of his predictions ever came true. Not a single one.
I remember him. Well, I remember. Well, I don't know if it was the Twilight Zone or some other old black and white show where they had a. It was revolved around that everybody was just walking around elbow to elbow. And so yeah. I have a feeling that a lot of those, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but maybe perhaps the Twilight Zone and some of those other Outer Limits types of shows were perhaps part of the technocracy ideal.
Well, I think at least they were reflecting what Ehrlich had to say about, population explosion. And, he was a scientist for sure, but you know what his discipline was? Entomology. He was a bug scientist. Okay. So he took all of his bug theories and applied it to mankind and made a prediction, you see, all right? He looked forward and said, this is certainly what's going to happen. And he found out in the end he didn't have any ability to predict anything, but he fooled everybody and screwed with people's minds for 25 years that we're all going to die from overpopulation. And he had adopted this philosophy that Saint Simon talked about, that scientists are superior to all other men. It's like, well, get out of here. You're a bug scientist, for crying out. Go catch some bugs out in the field or something, But don't tell me I'm a bug and that the human race is going to be like a horde of locusts or something that come out every 10 years. It's ridiculous. But this kind of stuff happens all the time. And a pseudoscience is what it is. But, still they use it to impose their will, and it has a very religious flavor to it.
Yeah, well, religion comes in all forms. Now, I've heard this term... that it seems to be going around more and more, not in necessarily a good way, but I keep hearing this term scientific dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like what you're referring to is basically this notion that, it's basically that science somehow replaces the notion of God.
That's
a strange concept, because science is really supposed to be the study of the creation of nature, the creation of God, but then somehow science sort of steps and takes the place of God.
And that's right. There is a philosophy called scientism, and that very accurately describes kind of the underpinnings of all of this. Scientism says that the only way to discover truth about matter reality is through science and the scientific method. This doesn't hold much water in my mind, because when you start, you know, talking about things like love and jealousy and anger and whatever, I mean, it falls apart. There's lots of truth outside of the scientific method and, you know, science, so to speak. But when somebody gets their mindset on this scientism aspect, it excludes God. They believe they can foretell the future. If anybody doesn't agree, they're rejected out of hand. And it demands acceptance by non-scientists. And so, you know, it becomes a cult of science in a sense, you know, where the priesthood, that is the scientists, make inquiry of the oracle, which is, you know, which is science. And they come back and tell us, well, science says this today, and so says science, you know, and you better bow down and you know, worship or whatever at the altar of science, because if you don't, you know, the world's going to burn up and the seas are going to rise and et cetera, and everything's going to go south. It's kind of like the old, you know, the old cult of the volcano that we used to joke about when we were younger, you know, where a virgin needs to be sacrificed, and the guy comes down and says, prepare two virgins for next Monday, you know, or whatever. And the people go out and they grab some poor young girl and they take her up, throw her in the volcano. So what's that all about? Well, they're just a bunch of idiots, the blind leading the blind, and they both fall into a pit.
Yeah.
But the science, the essence of scientism, the essence of scientific dictatorship, is that it's not a person telling you what to do. It's science telling you what to do. It's the methodology that takes you to a place where you have to obey. It's not like, for instance, if President Obama was a dictator all of a sudden. I can't believe I said that. But let's say he becomes a dictator. Well, he's one person. He's finite. He's, you know, he's got a point in time, place, whatever, space. He can't come out and tell you what to do personally. But the system of the scientific method that's encroaching around us today, with all of the, you know, whether it be federal databases, whether it be the, you know, the methodology of the economic system that's being imposed and stuff today, options are closing in on us. We can't move left or right anymore like we used to be able to. Our freedoms are being taken away, and the system itself is taking us over. You mentioned the word, though, scientific dictatorship, which brings up to mind the book by Aldous Huxley called Brave New World. Maybe you've read that along the way.
Oh, boy.
Brave New World was written, you won't believe this, in 1932 at the height of technocracy in the United States. Now, Huxley was from overseas. He's from Great Britain. But he was looking into the face of technology when he got the inspiration to write the book Brave New World.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying I agree with everything he said, but I'm just saying, as a fiction writer, okay, he saw an opportunity to write a book on some fantastical thing, and he did, and he carried it to an extreme. And that is where we, you and I, get the word or concept, scientific dictatorship, okay, universally. If anybody says that, the next words out of their mouth are Brave New World.
Right.
So if you read Brave New World, you will get an idea of what one man of that era thought about this utopian scheme. And you'll learn something from it.
Well, and I'll tell you what, thanks to Jan Irvin over at Gnostic Media, he's certainly uncovered the Huxley role in all of the MK Ultra and all of the CIA stuff. So unfortunately, Huxley wasn't necessarily a good guy.
Not at all. You're right.
So unfortunately, you know, you have to take a lot of these things. And you said that the original writer or concept father of technocracy came from France, and I've really been drawn to a lot of the French writings, from Bastiat to Baudrillard to all these. It seems like a lot of the thoughts of today come from that French Revolution period, from the 1400s, 1500s on. And not ironically, again, we're talking about another French author. The problem was, you know, as I was reading some of the introductions and explanations of the lives of these people, for instance, Bastiat, when he wrote The Law, you know, he was writing it, and it seems like, oh, this is a wonderful, wonderful expose on what freedom and law is supposed to be according to the natural law and God. But it turns out that he was hired by the king, and really was his intent, in other words, was not to free men, but to show how kings could rule men, because men were suspect or subject to the notion of being controlled. And you read the book as if it's a treatise on freedom, but it's really a treatise on control.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be the same sort of thing. I'm probably the same type of thing here with the technocracy.
I think so. The one of the magazines that they produced called The Technocrat in 1938 made kind of a pop definition of technocracy, and this is what they called it. This is a direct quote from their magazine. It says, "Technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific cooperation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population," close quote. That's how they viewed themselves. It was a science of social engineering. And so the scientists and engineers in various disciplines figured that they could take their disciplines and apply them to society with equal accuracy.
Well, that does make us sound a bit like bugs.
Sure does. We're just bags of atoms that just happen to be out here, and you know, we're the cattle in the feedlot, so to speak.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, this boils down to, and you know, just to be clear, folks, we often, you know, we talk about the notion of humanitarianism. We talk about humanism. Exactly, the word "human" itself. It's very important to understand that you can't have transhumanism unless you first convince people that they are merely human. Hu, of course, was the god of Sufism. So when you attach Hu to man, it's no longer man. When you look at the definitions of human, you find monster, for instance, having the qualities of man, but not man. It actually means, strangely, it means belonging to man. So just the qualities, the form, but not the substance of man. And this is very important to note when you're talking about humanitarianism, because humanitarianism specifically excludes God. Humanitarianism, Webster's New World Dictionary in 1988, the doctrine that humankind may become perfect without divine aid. In other words, scientism. Humanitarianism from 1928, a philanthropist, an anti-Trinitarian who rejects the doctrines of Christ's divinity, a perfectionist. Perfection without God, perfection without nature, folks. It's the notion that nothing is perfect and we have to strive to perfect it ourselves. Man must become something other than God created, is the idea of humanism, humanitarianism. It is the exclusion of the importance and the belief in God. We'll be back. Stay tuned, folks.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Earthquakes, hurricanes, nuclear accidents, terror attacks, and all-out social collapse. With the world today more volatile than ever, the future has never looked more uncertain. Survivalist Magazine is the one resource you can't afford to be without. Claim your free trial subscription now at www.survivalist.com and your first issue ships immediately. Get all the details and more at www.survivalist.com or order by phone. Call 1-866-437-6570. Your survival may depend on it.
Americans are reeling from Obamacare, higher prices, and an epidemic of policy lapses. AsiaRunLikeHellGuide.com has you covered. World-class medical and surgery at one of Asia's most modern hospitals. 300 doctors, surgeons, and dentists serving 300,000 patients a year. Fractions of U.S. prices. Friends or family forced to go out of pocket? Avoid bankruptcy. Tell them to run. Run like hell. Hit us up now. We'll show you how. AsiaRunLikeHellGuide.com.
Has your dancing and romancing done gone away? Are you moaning and a-groaning from the stresses of the day? Are you reeling and a-peeling because a headache's on the way? Well, relax for just a moment. Stress relief is on the way. Of what am I speaking, you ask? The essential oils of long historic use, the wisdom of the ages, the health care of the ancients, frankincense, myrrh, hyssop, and hundreds of others too numerous to mention. What could be more appealing? Do you know that Young Living essential oils is an element of life that makes them extremely effective in body rejuvenation? This element is called vibration, and it works with body systems, not against them. The professionals at Divine Living Oils have tested and been so impressed with this product that we are using them to help others. And who are we? We are health professionals with many years' experience. Trust us, we have seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. Our motto? Because we care about you. Do your health and spirit a great favor. Call us at 304-542-4226. That's 304-542-4226. Again, that's 304-542-4226.
With autumn in the air, it's time to think about getting ready for winter. And it's time to save at HerbalHealer.com. You'll find amazing seasonal savings to prepare you for the fight against cold and flu season. Like Oregacillin to promote lung health. 30 capsules, regularly $34.95, now only $25. HHA Olive Leaf, the natural antiviral, normally $16.95, now 60 capsules are just $12. HHA Elderberry Power, a great flu and virus fighter, regularly $16.95, 60 capsules, now $10. Save on all our homeopathic detoxes. Choose from lungs, kidney, liver, brain, libido, or whole body, normally $26.95, now just $20. Visit HerbalHealer.com and click on the Fall Winter Specials button to save on all our natural cold and flu fighting products. Also explore our Herbal Healer Academy correspondence courses that teach you how to handle your health naturally. HerbalHealer.com, healing the world with nature, one person at a time, since 1988.
Dr. Joel Wallach, author of the famous health lecture, Dead Doctors Don't Lie, presents his newest book, Epigenetics. Epigenetics is required reading for the very survival of Americans, and yes, all of humanity. Modern man has bet on the wrong horse to save them from disease and pestilence. The medical system has failed us fearfully. Join the health revolution. Buy Epigenetics today and receive a free membership to purchase all the products that Dr. Joel Wallach formulated at wholesale prices and receive a free CD of Dead Doctors Don't Lie. All this for only $25 plus shipping and handling. Call 888-311-4311. That's 888-311-4311. Again, that's just $25 plus shipping and handling. And you'll receive the new book, Epigenetics, a free membership, and a free CD of Dead Doctors Don't Lie. Call 888-311-4311. That's
888-311-4311. My neighbor... Welcome again to this neighborhood. I'd like to show you something. You know what this is? Or maybe if I press this button.
There are so many things to learn about in this world. And so many people who can help us learn. And so many people who can help us learn.
Did you ever grow anything in the garden of your mind?
In the garden of your mind.
You can grow ideas in the garden of your mind.
In the garden of your mind.
It's good.
Corporation Nation. We are joined today by Patrick Wood. Patrick Wood, his website and the book is Technocracy Rising. The dark horse of the New World Order is not communism, socialism, or fascism. It is technocracy. Technocracyrising.com. Very interesting stuff. I noticed that you said a lot of this comes, you know, it always seems to be coming from the university system. And when I was researching the geoengineering thing, I put together a blog post about how geoengineering is being taught in the most prestigious schools, whether it be the alteration of the environment in the sky
or the water, whether reseeding the oceans, changing the acidity, etc., or, you know, land, which is thermal and volcano type of stuff, you know, that alteration of that. And I came upon, have you ever heard of the Washington Geoengineering Consortium?
Not specifically, but I get
well,
it.
Well, of course, it's one of the very important tools of this order we're talking, this technocracy we're talking about, which is the private association, the non-governmental private association that seems to run everything. It says the Washington Geoengineering Consortium is a collaboration between a set of academics from Johns Hopkins University and American University in Washington, D.C. Again, always seems like the university system is like the most evil thing on Earth. It says our goal is to generate space for perspectives from civil society actors and the wider public to produce a heightened level of engagement around issues of justice, agency, and inclusion. On November 4th, 2013, the Washington Geoengineering Consortium organized a meeting for civil society actors based in Washington, D.C. Did you hear that, folks? Civil society actors. This is one of the most important things you have no idea is going on. You're amongst a bunch of actors. The meeting brought together around 40 people from major environmental, developmental, and justice non-governmental organizations to consider the challenges and opportunities presented by geoengineering technologies. But what's most important in this closed-door meeting in Washington, D.C., from 30 different organizations, is this. The question was asked, how should civil society actors frame geoengineering? How should the actors who are pretending to be us and concerned citizens, how should they present or frame geoengineering to the public? And here's what it says. Some suggested that the dominant framing lies, in other words, for geoengineering now is as a solution to climate change. Few scientists, of course, would make such a claim, but the general public, the stupid people we are, may still construe the promise of geoengineering as, quote, this will make climate change go away, and so we don't have to change our behaviors. A few suggested that, to shift the conversation in productive ways, geoengineering should be characterized, publicly by the actors as a terrible choice. The last thing we want to do, geoengineering, in other words, can be viewed by civil society organizations as a strategic opening, as a way to bring home the horrors of climate change to policymakers and to the public. So here's exactly what you're talking about. It's a false dichotomy that is being created by what we call civil society actors, people who go to meetings and they're working for these NGOs. And I know you probably have a lot to say about non-governmental organizations, which again seem to be framing the entire morphing of our government, everything that we have ever believed in. All the institutions that have been around are being morphed by these non-governmental organizations. A very important part of this.
Indeed. Well, yeah, the whole geoengineering field at this point is a case of these scientists and engineers running ahead on their own. Of course, they got money to finance them to do this, but they're running ahead on their own to provide solutions to problems that really don't need solutions at all. And the reason they've done this is that they have predicted the future. They believe, honestly, they see the future. But they don't see the future. They see what they think is the future.
They see a model of the future, an image, basically.
Well, whatever. I mean, they get convinced that global warming is, you know, going to cause everybody in the world just to go crazy, and they have to do something about it. So instead of waiting for the normal processes of civil society to make decisions about such things that would affect it, they just take matters into their own hands as if they were the gods of the age, if you will, that know better, and say, we'll protect those foolish little people. We'll we'll just go do what's right, and they'll be happy that we've done this in the end. Well, you know, there's, I have to say there's a lot of psychopathic killers in jail that kind of said the same thing before they started their crime spree. You know, it's, like, it's really no different. You know, man cannot foresee the future, nor should he act on the future outside of the context of the people that are in his life. And these people have done that. And I think that geoengineering is a perfect example of this attitude that scientists and engineers are superior to all men.
Well, it is. It is. It's certainly a. Well, you know, it seems that the easiest way to describe it is when you say that men want to act as gods. What does that really mean? It really means that you're wanting to create a society, or, you know, to become the creator. And of course, the law, the maxims of law, are very specific in when it says the creator controls. If you create something, you control it. So if you can put yourself into this position of being, again, the scientific dictatorship, and you create the systems and you create the organizations and the associations that are basically whining and dining our politicians and basically passing them the bills. Our politicians don't write anything anymore. It's all coming from organizations and associations. So, I mean, you really are becoming godlike in the fact that you are altering creation itself to, and nature itself, to something that allows you to be creator. And that's a very, very frightening sense. Thus, I notice you talk about transhumanism, which is a very, very frightening thing when you get to the true state of it. But how can you control man unless you create in man something that is human, that is post-man? Or, you know, of course, we have to have a transitional period, transhumanism. What's the goal of transhumanism? Well, it allows men to control something that isn't man anymore, something that isn't a creation of God or nature.
You know, the transhuman movement itself writes very pointedly and frequently about how they are using science to take control of the evolutionary process to create the future according to their image and their desires rather than just random chance. They use that exact terminology. Up to now, of course, they would say that evolution has been random chance. There's no designer, no intelligent design whatsoever. But now, because they have control over the genome, they have control over nanotechnology, matter, they have control over the mind, at least they think they do, that they can use this science to drive the evolutionary process in an intelligent way, and they're the intelligence behind it, and they're going to create humans 2.0.
Well, it strikes me that it's kind of like walking up to an airplane, an advanced, you know, sophisticated airplane with all the knobs and switches very similar to the DNA and the epigenome, and saying, well, there was no creator of this airplane. I'm just going to modify it a bit and say I'm the creator. It's a ridiculous notion on when you really think about it.
They're very serious about it, though. It's not, you know, and again, this is the top leading scientists and engineers in the world that are racing after transhumanism like there's no tomorrow. They really believe that they're going to do this. And, I mean, it's just, you know, I could talk just on transhumanism for hours. It's just an amazing community of people. But it's in all the universities across the entire planet now. And no matter where you go, I'm in Arizona. We have Arizona State University down here in Tempe, which is one of the major, major universities involved in everything wacko and, you know, sustainable development, all Agenda 21 stuff. It's incredible. They're hook, line, and sinker into it. But at at ASU, you will find a department of convergent science. And converging science really is a combination of four different departments, formerly of four different departments. So I guess they still exist, but you've got mind sciences, you've got biotechnology, you've got computer science, and you've got nanotechnology.
Scary combination.
Those four combinations are being put together in common departments so there can be interaction between them to focus on human improvement. In other words, to focus on the achievement of transhumanism. Now, you can go to any university practically, at least a major university, anywhere in the world, look at their curriculum, and type in convergent, and you will find that they're running after this too. So taxpayer money, by and large, has been used by these people to create these crazy scientific ideas that man can escape his body, that man can escape death, that man can escape ignorance and become omniscient, that he can go and travel anywhere in any form he wishes. These are all qualities that we know about God, of course. And they're literally trying to achieve godhood. And they believe that whoever created man, or, you know, maybe it was aliens, but whoever created man, they think that, whoever created man made some mistakes. And, you know, we have a tendency to want to fight each other, and we're ornery and cantankerous sometimes, and you know, those are bad things. We have wars, and we kill people, and we're selfish. And so mankind needs to be created to work out all those different traits, you see. We don't want to have people like that. We want to have humans 2.0 that get along with each other, happy little campers. No more wars, no more jealousy, no more greed.
No more mother and father.
That's right.
No more mammy, no more pappy.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's straight out of Brave New World.
Yeah, so now this is everywhere around the world, this idea of converging technologies. And, you know, it's being driven by some of the brightest minds that, in one sense, at least the most educated minds that the world has ever known. And yet, you know, you and I might look at it and say, well, they may be brilliant, but they have absolutely no common sense whatsoever. And, you know, whatever they're doing is probably more likely going to destroy mankind rather than come up with mankind 2.0.
It's frightening, and it's more frightening to know that this is all happening, again, sort of clandestinely, and it's just now sort of coming out more into the limelight, all through, you know, through education, which is probably the worst aspect of it, but through entertainment, through the, you know, I mean, this sounds a lot like the concept of the Matrix. I mean, it's a very frightening thing. Why don't you explain to people, speaking of that, why don't you explain to people, for those who might not know or who have just heard about it through some of the shock jocks out there, why don't you really, and we're going to go to a break here, I apologize, but why don't you really explain what the Trilateral Commission is? Because obviously, this is, you keep saying it, they're coming from that particular group.
Yes, yes. Is the break coming now, or should I start?
It's got about 3 minutes.
Okay. Zbigniew Brzezinski was co-founder of the Trilateral Commission in 1973 with David Rockefeller. But let me tell you what he wrote in his book, Between Two Ages, just a couple of years before that. Because Brzezinski was endeared to David Rockefeller. You know, it's the Beauty and the Beast kind of thing. You know, Rockefeller had the money, Brzezinski had the brains. They got together and they created a beautiful thing in their mind. But this is what he wrote. This was his attitude. Still is. Quote, the nation-state as a fundamental unit of man's organized life has ceased to be the principal creative force. International banks and multinational corporations are acting and planning in terms that are far in advance of the political concepts of the nation-state, close quote. That was Brzezinski's approach and mindset when he co-founded the Trilateral Commission. And, you know, there's nothing you can say about this. This man had no respect for nations or nation states, especially ours, and he believed that the corporate world, especially the bankers, were going to be driving all policies in the future. And in fact, this is really what I think both of us probably agree on that point, that this seems to be the case. But when the Trilateral Commission got going, this is an economic coup. They said they wanted to create a new international economic order. I didn't quite understand what the word new meant back then. But this is what they said. They wanted to promote interdependence, and they wanted to promote free trade by dismantling all the tariffs and trade barriers in the world. And so as they got into, embedded into the executive branch, initially through Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale, both of whom were members, by the way, they took over the executive branch to get their people appointed to all the economic positions in the intervening 40 years now. Example, the U.S. Trade Representative, who negotiates all of the treaties, they've been in the news. Right now they're negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that's going to be a killer if it ever gets passed. But there have been 12 USTRs since 1977, 12, all appointed by the president. 9 out of 12, including the present one, are members of the Trilateral Commission. 9 out of 12 over almost a 40-year period were members of the Trilateral Commission. Here's another one. The president appoints the World Bank president. The IMF gets appointed from Europe. But our president appoints the World Bank president. There have been 8 since 1973, only 8 presidents. 6 of those 8 have been members of the Trilateral Commission. Clue? National Security Advisors. There have been 17 NSAs since 1973. Henry Kissinger was back in those days, by the way. And 10 out of 17 have been members of the Trilateral Commission.
Nice shooting. Hey, that's a sweet AK-47 chest rig. Is that multicam?
Yep, got it from StrikeHardGear.com.
Strike what?
StrikeHardGear.com.
Set your sights on StrikeHardGear.com. Tough, tactical gear for your Soviet-style weapon that's made in the USA. Affordable, plus a no-questions-asked 30-day money-back guarantee and lifetime replacement warranty. StrikeHardGear.com. Go ahead. Pull the trigger.
The IRS is a private corporation, not a government agency. Income tax is collected by voluntary compliance. To learn to unvolunteer or discontinue volunteering into the IRS, visit escapeharassment.com and immediately implement Strategy 1. The process must be repeated each and every time. Paper, letter, envelope, presentment, etc. Always and forever. Failure equates to acceptance, subsequent resultant contract, and you pay or go to jail by your own consent and agreement contract. Avoid recontracting. Visit escapeharassment.com and implement Strategy 1 immediately. Bar lawyers and accountants won't help you. Why wait? Get Strategy 1 and immediately implement it to divorce the IRS today and forever. That's escapeharassment.com, Strategy 1, to be free from the IRS. escapeharassment.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Extendovite really works. Here is what people are saying.
A year ago, I was realizing that I was in serious problems with my heart. You know, I had these chest pains and so on. I realized that I had to do something and quick. I didn't want to go the medical route. So I started in doing some investigating, and somebody told me about these heart drops. I got on the heart drops prescribed dosage. Within 2 weeks, I immediately started seeing the results. This is working. I'm going to stick with it. I can't deny the fact that when I got on the heart drops initially, there was immediate help, an immediate turnaround.
To get your Extendovite, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Hi, my name is David Merlin from takefromcaesar.us. Income is defined in the tax code. All property is a cost, including labor, according to statute. You're deprived of the provisions of Section 83 whenever you pay an income tax on your compensation. According to Section 83, only the excess over the amount paid is gross income. The government can't so much as provide an interpretation of Section 83 of its own. Get your paradigm shift and understanding today at takefromcaesar.us.
Start to mold a new reality closer to the heart, closer to the heart. Blacksmith,
We are back here in the Corporation Nation. We're talking to Patrick Wood, author of Technocracy Rising, a very fascinating subject. And, of course, the the basis of all of our Agenda 21 sustainable development, smart growth, education, or so we call it, Common Core, state standards. All of this has to do with this group of people basically taking over incrementally everything we know as normal. Did you have more on the membership aspect of the Trilateral Commission?
Well, the Trilateral Commission, the way it got its name is because it had members from the U.S., actually North America, Europe, and Japan. That was the word tri, three geographic locations. They originally had about 300 members.
So it's a little more like triad.
Well, yeah. They had 300 members originally, a little bit more now, but not many. They were comprised of some top politicians like Jimmy Carter, you know, heads of state, and Walter Mondale. And you had academics, of course, like Brzezinski and Richard Gardner. You had directors of major corporate representatives like Caterpillar Tractor and Deere and Citicorp and Chase Manhattan and General Electric and so on, the big giant multinational corporations. You had members of the press, directors of companies that were the press in those days. Time Magazine, for instance, had a director that was a member of the commission. And they've changed over the years, but you don't apply for membership there. They pick you. They have an executive search committee that goes out and taps people for membership. So you have to wait for them to come to you. So it's been very selective. And what our original complaint was, these people meet every year at least one time, sometimes multiple times, to discuss policies and create policies. And then they take them back to their respective governments or countries, and they implement those policies without any respect whatsoever to the political system that exists in those countries. So in America, Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale brought policies back from the Trilateral Commission where two-thirds of the people voting on these things were not Americans at all. They were Europeans and Japanese. Congress didn't have a clue. And we were hopping up and down about this back then and said, I didn't care what their policies even were at that point. I knew they were bad for other reasons. But the issue was, this is not the way we operate in America. Europeans can't come in here and tell us how to conduct our business. Japanese can't come in here and tell us how to conduct our business. You know, this is the whole concept of a nation state.
Boy, so, were you wrong.
Yeah, well, I was wrong. That's right. They did it, and now they've done it, and here we are. But, you know, this has continued this way for all these years, and everybody's wondering, man, what happened? You know, where'd that freight train come from? And this is where it came from. These people have been on a quest, if you will, for a long time. And I might add, it's not a political quest at all. You know, when you talk about Marxism, it's a political system more than anything else. You talk about communism or socialism, it's a political system. you talk about fascism, it's a political system. But technocracy is a purely economic system, designed to control the complete economic machine with almost goose step methodology.
Well, I'm starting to think that things like money and politics are really just tools to keep us down, to keep us in control. They have no limitations on money, it seems, but it's just really to limit us. And without money, it seems like we'd actually have unlimited potential. So if you consider that in their regard, where they can create the money, and of course that's why the banks are members, then they really have unlimited potential. So, very scary. We'll be back, folks. Stay tuned.
With financial uncertainty.